Side 4, The Hidden City, The Tomilee, Book 3, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 109.
It will not matter, Quadge told him. The one called Zalasta is one of the wicked ones. I will make him into a fire which will never go out as well. I will let him burn forever in the time which does not move. The fire will be just as hot there as it will be here.
The snow was heavier and wetter after they crossed the rocky spine that divided the rivers flowing west from those that flowed east. The huge cloud of humid air that hung perpetually above the Astell marshes lapped against the eastern slopes of the mountains of Demak, unloosing phenomenal snowfalls that buried the forests and clogged the passes. The church knights grimly forced their way through sodden drifts as they followed the valley of the South Fork on the River Issos toward the Zemak town of Bosna. Patriarch Abriel of the Cyrenic Knights had begun this campaign with a certain sense of well-being. His health was good, and a lifetime of military training had kept him in peak physical condition. He was, however, fast approaching his 70th year, and he found that starting out each morning was growing harder and harder, though he would never have admitted that. About mid-morning on a snowy day, one of the scouting parties ranging ahead returned with three goatskin-clad Zemaks. The men were thin and dirty, and they had terrified expressions on their faces. Patriarch Bergsten rode ahead to question them. When the rest of the main force caught up to the gigantic churchman, he was having a rather heated discussion with an Archean knight.
"But they're Zemaks, Your Grace," the knight protested.
"Our quarrel was with Osev, Sir Knight," Bergsten said coldly. "Not with these poor superstitious devils. Give them some food and warm clothing, and let them go. But we're not going to have trouble about this, are we, Sir Knight?" Bergsten asked in an ominous tone, swelling even larger.
The knight seemed to consider his situation. He backed up a few paces.
No, Your Grace," he replied. "I don't believe so."
"Our Holy Mother appreciates your obedience, my son," Bergsten told him.
"Did those three have anything useful for us?" Comier asked.
"Not much," Bergsten replied, hauling himself back up into his saddle. "There's an army of some kind moving into place somewhere to the east of Argoch. There was a lot of superstition mixed up in what they told me, so I couldn't get anything very accurate out of them."
"A fight, then," Comier said, rubbing his hands together in anticipation.
"I sort of doubt that," Bergsten disagreed. "As closely as I could make out from all the gibberish, the force up ahead is composed largely of irregulars, religious fanatics of some kind. Our Holy Mother in Kyrellos didn't make many friends in this part of the world when she tried to re-assimilate the branches of Aline faith in Western Daresia during the 9th century.
"That was almost 2,000 years ago, Bergsten," Comier objected. "That's a long time to hold a grudge."
Bergsten shrugged.
"The old ones are the best. Send your scouts out a little farther, Comier. Let's see if we can get some kind of coherent report on the welcoming committee. A few prisoners might be useful."
"I know how to do this, Bergsten."
"Do it, then. Don't just sit there talking about it."
They passed Argoch, and Comier's scouts brought in several prisoners. Patriarch Bergsten interrogated the poorly clad and ignorant Aline captives briefly, and then he ordered them released.
"Your Grace," Darrellin protested, "that was very unwise. Those men will run back to their commanders and report everything they've seen."
"Yes," Bergsten replied. "I know. I want them to do that. I also want them to tell all their friends that they've seen 100,000 church knights coming down out of the mountains. I'm encouraging defections, Darrellin. We don't want to kill those poor misguided heretics. We just want them to get out of our way."
"I still think it's strategically unsound, Your Grace."
"You're entitled to your opinion, my son," Bergsten said. "This isn't an article of the faith, so our Holy Mother encourages disagreement and discussion."
"There isn't much point to discussion after you've already let them go, Your Grace."
"You know, that very same thought occurred to me."
they encountered the opposing force in the broad valley of the River Issos, just to the south of the Zemak town of Bosna, 30 leagues or so to the west of the Estelian border. The reports of the scouts and the information gleaned from the captives proved to be accurate. What faced them was not so much an army as it was a mob, poorly armed and undisciplined. The preceptors of the four orders gathered around Patriarch Bergsten to consider options.
"They're members of our own faith," Bergsten told them. "Our disagreements with them lie in the area of church government, not in the substance of our common beliefs. Those matters aren't settled on the battlefield, so I don't want too many of those people killed."
"I don't see much danger of that, Your Grace," Preceptor Abriel said. "They outnumber us about 2-1, Lord Abriel," Sir Heldon pointed out. "One charge should even things out, Heldon," Abriel replied. "Those people are amateurs, enthusiastic but untrained, and about half of them are only armed with pitchforks. If we all drop our visors, level our lances, and charge them en masse, most of them will still be running a week from now." And that was the last mistake the venerable Lord Abriel was ever to make. The mounted knights fanned out with crisp precision to form up on a broad front stretching across the entire valley. Rank after rank of Cyrenics, Pandians, Genidians, and Alcyones, all clad in steel and mounted on belligerent horses, lined up in what was probably one of the more intimidating displays of organized unfriendliness in the known world. The preceptors waited in the very center of the front rank as their subalterns formed up the rear ranks, and the messengers galloped forward to declare that all was in readiness.
"That should be enough," Comier said impatiently. "I don't think the supply wagons will have to charge, too."
He looked around at his friends.
"Shall we get started, gentlemen? Let's show that rabble out there how real soldiers mount an attack."
He made a curt signal to a hulking Genidian knight, and the huge blonde man blew a shattering blast on his ogre horn trumpet. The front rank of the knights clapped down their visors and spurred their horses forward. The perfectly disciplined knights and horses galloped forward in an absolutely straight line like a moving wall of steel. Midway through the charge, the forest of upraised lances came down like a breaking wave, and the defections in the opposing army began. The ill-trained serfs and peasants broke and ran, throwing away their weapons and squealing in terror. Here and there were some better-trained units that held their ground, but the flight of their allies from either side left their flanks dangerously exposed. The knights struck those few units with a great resounding crash. Once more, Abriel felt the old exulting satisfaction of battle. His lance shattered against a hastily raised shield, and he discarded the broken weapon and drew his sword. He looked around and saw that there were other forces massed behind the wall of peasants that had concealed them from view, and that army was like none Abriel had ever seen before. The soldiers were huge, larger than even the Thalesians. They wore breastplates and mail, but their cuirasses were more closely molded to their bodies than was normal. Every muscle seemed starkly outlined under the gleaming steel. Their helmets were exotic steel recreations of the heads of improbable beasts, and they did not have visors as such, but steel masks instead, masks that had been sculpted to bear individualized features. The features, Abriel thought, of the warriors who wore them. The Cyrenic preceptor was suddenly chilled. The features the masks revealed were not human. There was a strange domed leather tent in the center of that inhuman army, a ribbed, glossy black tent of gigantic dimensions. But then it moved, opening, spreading wide, two great wings, curved and bat-like, and then, rising up from under the shelter of those wings, was a being huge beyond imagining, a creature of total darkness, with a head shaped like an inverted wedge, and with flaring, pointed ears. Two slitted eyes blazed in that awful absence of a face, and two enormous arms stretched forth hungrily. Lightning seethed beneath the glossy black skin, and the earth upon which the creature stood smoked and burned. Abriel was strangely calm. He lifted his visor to look full into the face of hell. "At last," he murmured, "a fitting opponent."
And then he clapped his visor down again, drew his warlike shield before his body, and raised the sword he had carried with honor for over half a century. His unpalsied hand brandished the sword at the enormity still rising before him. "For God and Archaeum!" he roared his defiance, set himself, and charged directly into obliteration. Chapter 8. To say that Edamus was offended would be the grossest of understatements. The blur of white light that was the god of the Delphae was tinged around the edges with flickers of reddish-orange, and the dusting of snow that covered the ground in the little swale above the valley of the Delphae fumed tendrils of steam as it melted in the heat of his displeasure.
"No," he said adamantly, "absolutely not."
"Oh, be reasonable, cousin," Afriel coaxed. "The situation has changed. You're holding on to something that no longer has any meaning. There might have been some justification for eternal enmity before. I'll grant you that my family didn't behave very well during the war with the Seer guy, but that was a long time ago. Clinging to your injured sensibilities now is pure childishness."
"How couldst thou, Zanisha?" Edamus demanded accusingly. "How couldst thou do this thing?"
"It was in furtherance of our design, beloved," she replied.
Sophronia was more than a little startled by the intensely personal relationship Zanisha had with her god.
"Thou didst command me to render assistance unto Annika, and by reason of his love for Sophronia, I was obliged to reach accommodation with her. Once she and I did breach the wall of enmity which did stand between us, and did learn to trust each other, respect and common purpose did soften our customary despite, and all unbidden, love did gently creep in to replace it. In my heart, she is now my dear sister."
"That is an abomination. Thou shalt not speak so of this Styric in my presence again."
"As it pleased thee, beloved," she agreed,
submissively bowing her head. But then her chin came up, and her inner light glowed more intensely.
"But will ye, nill ye, I will continue to think of her so in the hidden silence of my heart." "Are you ready to listen, Edamus?" Afriel asked. "Or would you like to take a century or two to throw a temper tantrum first?"
"Thou art pert, Afriel," he accused.
"Yes, I know. It's one of the things that makes me so delightful. You do know that Sirgon's trying to get his hands on Belium, don't you? Or have you been so busy playing leapfrog with the stars that you've lost track of what's happening here?"
"Mind your manners," Sophronia told her crisply.
"He makes me tired. He's been cuddling his hatred to his breast like a sick puppy for 10,000 years.
The child goddess looked critically at the incandescent presence of the god of the Delphae.
"The light show doesn't impress me, Edamus. I could do it too if I wanted to take the trouble."
Edamus flared even brighter, and the reddish-orange nimbus around him became sooty.
"How tiresome," Afriel sighed. "I'm sorry, Zanisha, but we're wasting our time here. Belium and I are going to have to deal with Clell on our own. Your tedious god wouldn't be any help anyway."
"Clell?" Edamus gasped.
"Got your attention, didn't I?" She smirked. "Are you ready to listen now?"
"Who hath done this? Who hath unloosed Clell again upon the earth?"
"Well, it certainly wasn't me. Sirgon had everything going his way, and then Annika turned things around on him. You know how much Sirgon hates to lose, so he started breaking the rules. Did you want to help us with this, or would you rather sit around and pout for another 100 eons or so?" "Quickly, quickly, Edamus," she said, snapping her fingers at him. "Make up your mind. I don't have all day, you know."
"What makes you think I need any more men?" Narstal demanded.
Narstal was a lean, almost cadaverous Arjunai, with stringy arms and hollow cheeks. He sat at a table set under a spreading tree in the center of his encampment deep in the jungles of Arjuna. "You're in a risky kind of business," Kalador shrugged, looking around at the cluttered camp. "You steal furniture and carpets and tapestries. That means that you've been raiding villages and mounting attacks on isolated estates. People fight back when you try that, and that means casualties. About half of your men are wearing bandages right now, and you probably leave a few dead behind you every time you try to steal things." A leader in your line always needs more men.
I don't have any vacancies just now.
I can arrange some, Bevier told him in a menacing voice, melodramatically drawing his thumb across the edge of his Lochaber.
Look, Narstal, Kalidor said in a somewhat less abrasive tone. We've seen your men. Be honest now. You've gathered up a bunch of local bad boys who got into trouble for stealing chickens or running off somebody else's goats. You're very light on professionals, and that's what we're offering you. Professionalism. Your bad boys bluster and try to impress each other by looking mean and nasty, but real killing isn't in their nature, and that's why they get hurt when the fighting starts. Killing doesn't bother us. We're used to it. Your young bravos have to prove things to each other, but we don't. Ordin knows who we are. He wouldn't have sent you that letter otherwise. His eyes narrowed slightly. Believe me, Narstal, life will be much easier for all of us if we're working with you rather than setting up shop across the street.
Narstal looked a little less certain of himself.
I'll think about it, he said.
Do that, and don't get any ideas about trying to eliminate potential competition in advance. Your bad boys wouldn't be up to it, and my friends and I would sort of be obliged to take it personally.
Stop that, Sophronia chided her sister, as the four of them moved through the corridor-like streets of Delphaeus toward the home of Sedon, the Anorai of Zanisha's people.
Edamus is doing it, Aphriel countered.
It's his city, and these are his people. It's not polite to do that when you're a guest.
Zanisha gave them a puzzled look.
My sister's showing off, Sophronia explained.
Am not, Aphriel retorted.
Yes, you are too, Aphriel, and you and I both know it. We've had this argument before. Now stop it.
I do not understand, Zanisha confessed.
That's because you've grown accustomed to the sense of her presence, sister, Sophronia explained wearily. She's not supposed to flaunt her divinity this way when she's around the worshippers of other gods. It's the worst form of bad manners, and she knows it. She's only doing it to irritate Edamus. I'm surprised she hasn't flattened the whole city or set fire to the thatching on the roofs with all that divine personality.
That's a spiteful thing to say, Sophronia, Aphriel accused.
Behave yourself, then.
I won't unless Edamus does.
Sophronia sighed, rolling her eyes upward. They entered the southern wing of the extended city building that was Delphaeus and proceeded down a dim hallway to Sedon's door. The Anorai was waiting for them, his ancient face filled with wonder. He fell to his knees as the light that was Edamus approached, but his god dimmed, assumed a human form, and reached out gently to raise him to his feet again.
"That is not needful, my old friend," he said.
"Why, Edamus," Aphriel said, "you're really quite handsome. You shouldn't hide from us in all that light the way you do."
A faint smile touched the ageless face of the Delphaic god.
Seek not to beguile me with flattery, Aphriel. I know thee, and I know thy ways. Thou shalt not so easily ensnare me.
Oh, really? Thou art ensnared already, Edamus. I do but toy with thee now. My hand is already about thine heart. In time I shall close it and make thee mine.
And she laughed a silvery little peal of laughter.
But that's between you and me, cousin. Right now we have other things to do.
Zanisha fondly embraced the ancient Sedon.
As thou canst readily perceive, my dear old friend, momentous changes are afoot. The dire peril which we face doth reshape our entire world. Let us consider that peril first, and then at our leisure may we pause to marvel at how all about us is altered.
Sedon led them down the three worn steps into his low-ceilinged chamber with its inwardly curving white-plastered walls, its comfortable furniture, and its cheery fire.
"Tell them what's been going on, Zanisha," Aphriel suggested, climbing up into Sophronia's lap. "That may explain why it was necessary for me to violate all the rules and come here."
She gave Edamus an arch look.
"Regardless of what you may think, cousin, I do have good manners. But we've got an emergency on our hands."
Sophronia leaned back in her chair as Zanisha began her account of the events of the past several months. There was a sense of peace, an unruffled calm about Delphaeus that Sophronia had not perceived during her last visit. At that time, her mind had been so filled with obsessive hatred that she had scarcely taken note of her surroundings. The Delphae had appealed to Sparhawk to seal their valley away from the rest of the world, but that seemed somehow unnecessary. They were already separate, so separate that they no longer seemed even human. In a peculiar way, Sophronia envied them.
"Infuriating, aren't they?" the child goddess murmured. "And the word you're looking for is serenity. And you're doing everything in your power to disturb that, aren't you? They're still a part of this world, Sophronia. For a little while longer, anyway. All I'm doing is reminding them that the rest of us are still out here. You're behaving very badly toward Eudamus. I'm trying to jerk him back to reality. He's been off by himself for the past 100 centuries, and he's forgotten what it's like having the rest of us around. I'm reminding him. Actually, it's good for him. He was starting to get complacent."
She slipped down from her sister's lap.
"Excuse me," she said. "It's time for me to give him another lesson."
She crossed the room and stood directly in front of Eudamus, looking pleadingly into his face with her large, dark eyes. The god of the Delphae was so engrossed in Zanisha's account that he scarcely noticed Aphriel, and when she held her arms out to him, he absently picked her up and settled her into his lap. Sophronia smiled.
"And most recently," Zanisha concluded her report, "young Sir Barrett has been given further instruction. He is to turn aside and go to the town of Sopal on the coast of the Sea of Arjun. He hath advised the child goddess of this alteration of direction, and she in turn hath made the rest of us aware of it. It is the intent of the troll gods to transport Sir Ulaf and Sir Tinian to Sopal and to conceal them there in what they call no time. It is their thought that when our enemies produce Queen Aelana to exchange her for Belium, they might leap from their concealment and rescue her."
"No time?" Seaton asked, his face puzzled.
"Suspended duration," Aphriel explained. "Trolls are hunters, and their gods have found a new place of concealment for them, so that they're able to stalk their prey unseen. It's clever, but it has its drawbacks."
Eudamus asked her something in that language Sophronia had tried several times to learn, but had never really been able to grasp. Aphriel replied, speaking rapidly in a rather dry, technical tone, and making intricate gestures with her hands.
"Ah,"
he said finally, lapsing back into Tamil, and with an expression of comprehension flooding his face.
"It is a peculiar notion."
"You know how the troll gods are."
She made a little face.
"Didst thou in truth wring acceptance of thine outrageous demands from them?"
"I had something they wanted."
She shrugged.
"They've been trying to think up some way to escape from Belium for 300 centuries now. They didn't like my conditions very much, but they didn't have much choice."
"Thou art cruel, Aphriel."
"Not really. I was driven by necessity, and necessity's neither cruel nor kindly. It just is. I kissed them a few times when I stopped by a couple of days ago, and that made them feel better. It did once they realized that I wasn't going to take a bite out of them anyway."
"Thou didst not!"
He seemed aghast.
"They aren't so bad,"
she defended her action.
"I suppose I could have scratched them behind the ears instead, but that might have insulted them, so I kissed them instead."
She smiled.
"A few more kisses, and I'd have had them licking my fingers like puppies."
He straightened, then suddenly blinked, as if realizing for the first time where she was sitting. She gave him another of those mysterious little smiles, and patted his cheek.
"That's all right, cousin," she told him. "You'll come around eventually. They always do."
And she slipped down from his lap and walked back across the room to rejoin her sister.
"That's my place,"
a burly fellow of indeterminate race asserted threateningly, as Calton dropped his saddlebags and bedroll on a clear spot under a large tree.
"It was," Calton grunted. "You can't just walk in here and steal a man's place like this."
"Oh? Is it against the law or something?" Calton straightened. He was at least a head taller than the other man, and he bulked large in his mail shirt.
"My friends and I are going to be staying right here,"
he stated flatly. So pick up your bed and all this other trash and go someplace else.
I'm not in the habit of taking orders from Aline's.
That's too bad. Now move away. I've got work to do. Carlton was not in a good humor. Aline's peril gnawed at him constantly, and even slight irritations rubbed his temper raw. Some of that must have showed on his face. The other man backed off a few steps.
Farther,
Carlton told him.
I'll be back, the man blustered, retreating a few more steps. I'll be back with all my friends. I can hardly wait.
Carlton deliberately turned his back on the man he had just dispossessed. Collador and Bevier joined him.
Trouble?
Collador asked.
I wouldn't call it that, Carlton shrugged. I was just establishing some rank is all. Any time you come into a new situation, you have to push a few people around to make everybody else understand that you're not going to put up with any foolishness. Let's get settled in.
They had erected their tent and were gathering leaves and moss for beds when Narstal stopped by.
I see you're getting set up, Ezek, he said to Kaalador. His tone was conciliatory, though not quite cordial.
A few finishing touches are about all that's left, Kaalador replied.
You men make a good camp, Narstal noted. Tidy.
A cluttered camp is the sign of a cluttered mind, Kaalador declared. I'm glad you stopped by, Narstal. We hear that there's an army camped out not far from here. Do they cause you any problems?
We've got an agreement with them, Narstal replied. We don't steal from them, and they leave us alone. That's not a real army in the Taios, though. It's more like a large band of rebels. They want to overthrow the government.
Doesn't everybody? Narstal laughed.
Actually, having that mob in the Taios is very good for my business. The fact that they're all there keeps the police out of this part of the jungle, and one of the reasons they tolerate us is because we rob travelers, and that keeps people from snooping around the Taios. We do a fairly brisk business with them. They're a ready market for just about everything we steal.
How far is this Natayos place from here?
About 10 miles. It's an old ruin. Skarka, he's the one in charge over there, moved in with his rebels a couple of years back. He's fortified it, and he's bringing in more of his followers every day. I don't care much for him, but business is business.
What's he like?
He's crazy. Some days he's so crazy that he bays at the moon. He's convinced that he'll be emperor one day, and I expect it won't be long until he marches his rabble out of those ruins. He's fairly safe in this jungle, but just as soon as he gets out into open country, the Aetons will grind him into dog meat right on the spot.
Are we supposed to care about that? Bevier asked.
I personally couldn't care less, Narstal assured the apparently one-eyed ruffian. It's the loss of his business that concerns me.
Can just about anybody walk in and out of Natayos any time he feels like it? Carlton asked, as if only mildly curious.
If you're leading a mule loaded down with food or drink, they'll welcome you with open arms. I send an ox cart loaded down with barrels of ale every few days. You know how soldiers like their ale.
Oh, yes, Carlton agreed. I've known a few soldiers in my time, and their whole world stops when somebody opens an ale barrel.
It doth derive from our ability to control the light which doth emanate from us, Seaton explained. What we call sight is profoundly influenced by light. The subterfuge is not perfect. Some faint shimmers do appear, and we must be wary lest our shadows reveal our presence. But with a certain care we can be unobserved.
Now there are some interesting contrasts, Afriel said. The troll gods tamper with time, you tamper with light, and I tamper with the attention of the people I want to hide from. But it's all an attempt to achieve some measure of invisibility. Knowest thou of any who can be truly invisible, Divine One?
Zenisha asked.
I don't. Do you, cousin?
Edamus shook his head. "We can come close, though," the child goddess said. "The real thing would probably have drawbacks. It's a very good idea, Anoriseden, but I don't want Zenisha to put herself in any kind of danger. I love her too much for that."
Zenisha flushed slightly, and then she gave Edamus an almost guilty look. Sophronia laughed.
"I must in honesty warn thee, Edamus," she said. "Guard well thy worshippers. My goddess is a notorious thief."
She frowned thoughtfully.
"If Zenisha could go unobserved into Sopal, it could be very useful. Her ability to reach into the thoughts of others would enable her to discover in short order whether Elana's there or not. If she is, we can take steps. If not, we'll know that Sopal's just another diversion."
Sedon looked at Edamus. "I think, beloved one, that we must extend our involvement in the world around us farther than we had earlier planned. Annika's concern for the safety of his wife doth take precedence in his mind o'er all else, and his promise to us doth stand in peril until she be returned to him safe and whole."
Edamus sighed. "It may be e'en as thou sayest, my Anorai. Though it doth make me unquiet, it would appear that we must set aside our repugnance and join in the search for Annika's wife, lending such aid as is within our power."
"Are you really sure you want to become involved in this, Edamus?"
Afriel asked him.
"Really, really sure?"
"I have said it, Afriel.
Aren't you the least bit interested in why I'm so concerned with the fate of a pair of Alines? Alines do have their own god, you know. Why do you imagine that I'd be so interested in them?"
"Why is it ever thy wont to speak circuitously, Afriel?"
"Because I love to surprise people," she replied sweetly. "I really do want to thank you for your concern about the well-being of my mother and father, cousin. You've touched me to the very heart."
He stared at her in stunned astonishment.
"Doubt it's not," he gasped.
"Somebody had to do it,"
she shrugged.
"One of us has to keep an eye on Belium. Annika is Belium's creature, but as long as I have my hand around his heart, I can more or less control the things he does."
"But they're Alines."
"Oh, grow up, Edamus. Alines, Styrix, Delphae, what difference does it make? You can love all of them if your heart's not closed."
"But they eat pigs."
"I know."
She shuddered.
"Believe me, I know. It's one of the things I've been working on."
Senga was a good-natured brigand whose racial origins were so mixed that no one could really tell what he was. He grinned a great deal, and he was loud and boisterous, and had an infectious laugh. Carlton liked him, and Senga appeared to have found a kindred spirit in the Aline outlaw he knew as Kahl. He was laughing as he came across Narstal's cluttered compound, where furniture and other household goods were stacked in large, untidy heaps on the bare ground. "Ho, Kahl!" he shouted, as he approached the tree where Carlton, Kahlador, and Devier had pitched their tent. "You should have come along. An ox-cart load of ale opens every door in the Taios." "Armies make me nervous, Senga," Carlton replied. "The officers are always trying to enlist you, usually at sword point, and generals as a group tend to be overly moralistic for my taste. The term martial law makes my blood run cold for some reason."
"Scarpa grew up in a tavern, my friend," Senga assured him, "and his mother was a whore, so he's accustomed to the seamier side of human nature."
"How did you make out?" Carlton asked. Senga grinned, rolled his eyes, and jingled a heavy purse.
"Well enough to make me consider giving up crime and opening my own brewery. The only problem with that is the fact that our friends at Natayos probably won't be there all that much longer. If I set up shop as a brewer and my customers all marched off to get killed by the Etons, I'd probably have to drink all that ale by myself, and nobody's that thirsty."
"Oh? What makes you think those rebels are getting ready to leave?"
"Nothing very specific," Senga said, sprawling out on the ground and offering Carlton his wineskin. "Scarp has been gone for the past several weeks. He and two or three Alines left Natayos last month, and nobody I talked with knew where he was going or why.
Calton carefully kept his expression disinterested.
I hear that he's crazy. Crazy men don't need reasons for the things they do or the places they go.
Scarp is crazy enough, all right, but he can certainly whip those rebels of his into a frenzy. When he decides to make a speech, you'd better find a comfortable place to sit, because you're going to be there for 6 hours at least. Anyway, he went off a while back, and his army was getting settled in for the winter. That's all changed now that he's back.
Calton became very alert.
He's come back?
That he has, my friend. Here, give us a drink.
Senga took the wineskin and tipped it up, squirting a long stream of wine into his mouth. Then he wiped his chin on the back of his hand.
He and those Aline friends of his came riding into Natayos not 4 days ago. They had a couple of women with them, I hear.
Calton sank down on the ground and made some show of adjusting his sword belt to cover his sudden excitement.
I thought Scarpa hated women, he said,
trying to keep his voice casual.
Oh, that he does, my friend. But from what I hear, these two women weren't just some playthings he picked up along the way. They had their hands tied, for one thing, and the fellow I talked with said that they were a little bedraggled, but they didn't look like tavern wenches. He didn't get a very good look at them, because Scarpa hustled them into a house that seems to have been fixed up for somebody a little special. Fancy furniture and rugs on the floor and all that.
Was there anything unusual about them?
Calton almost held his breath. Senga shrugged and took another drink.
Just the fact that they weren't treated like ordinary camp followers, I suppose.
He scratched his head.
There was something else the fellow told me, he said. What was it now?
Calton did hold his breath this time.
Oh, yes, Senga said. Now I remember.
The fellow said that these two women Scarpa took all the trouble to invite to Natayos were Alines.
Isn't that odd?
Chapter 9. The town of Beressa on the southeastern Arjunai coast was a low, unlovely place, squatting toad-like on the beach lying between the South Tamil Sea and the swampy green jungle behind it. The major industry of the region was the production of charcoal, and acrid smoke hung in the humid air over Beressa like a curse. Captain Sorgai dropped his anchor some distance out from the wharves and went ashore to consult with the harbor master. Sparhawk, Stragan, and Talon, wearing their canvas smocks, leaned on the port rail, staring across the smelly water toward their destination.
I have an absolutely splendid idea, Fran, Stragan said to Sparhawk.
Oh,
Sparhawk replied.
Why don't we jump ship?
Nice try, Vimer,
Talon laughed. They were all more or less at ease with the assumed names by now. Sparhawk looked around carefully to make sure that none of the rest of the crew was near.
An ordinary sailor wouldn't leave without collecting his pay. Let's not do anything to attract attention. All that's really left to do is the unloading of the cargo. Under the threat of the bosun's whip, Stragan added glumly. That man really tests my self-control. Just the sight of him makes me want to kill him. We can endure him this one last time, Sparhawk told him. This town's going to be full of unfriendly eyes. Krager's bound to have people here to make sure I'm not trying to sneak in reinforcements behind his back. That might just be the flaw in his whole plan, Fran, Stragan said. Sorgai knows that we're not ordinary sailors. Is he the kind to let things slip?
Sparhawk shook his head.
Sorgai knows how to keep his mouth shut. He was paid to get us to Beressa unnoticed, and Sorgai always does what he's paid to do.
The captain returned late that afternoon, and they raised anchor and eased up to one of the long wharves protruding out into the harbor. They unloaded the cargo the next morning. The bosun cracked his whip only sparingly, and the unloading proceeded rapidly. Then, when the cargo holds were all emptied, the sailors lined up and filed along the quarterdeck where Sorgai sat at a small table with his account book and his stacks of coins. The captain gave each sailor a little speech as he paid him. The speeches varied slightly, but the general message was the same.
Stay out of trouble, and get back to the ship on time. I won't wait for you when the time comes to sail."
He did not alter the speech when he paid Sparhawk and his friends, and his face did not in any way betray the fact they were anything other than ordinary crew members. Sparhawk and his two friends went down the gangway with their sea bags on their shoulders and with a certain amount of anticipation.
"Now I see why sailors are so rowdy when they reach port," Sparhawk said. "That wasn't really much of a voyage, and I still feel a powerful urge to kick over the traces."
"Where to?" Talon asked when they reached the street.
"There's an inn called the Seaman's Rest," Stragan replied. "It's supposed to be a clean, quiet place, out beyond the main battle zone here along the waterfront. It should give us a base of operations to work from."
The sun was just going down as they passed through the noisy, reeking streets of Varessa. The buildings were constructed for the most part of squared-off logs, since stone was rare here on the vast, soggy delta of the Arjun River, and the logs appeared to have been attacked by damp rot almost before they were in place. Moss and fungus grew everywhere, and the air was thick with the chill damp and the acrid wood smoke from the charcoal yards outside of town. The Arjunis in the streets were noticeably more swarthy than their Tamil cousins of the north. Their eyes were shifty, and even their most casual gait through the muddy streets of their unlovely town seemed somehow furtive. Sparhawk muttered the spell under his breath as they passed along the shabby street, and he released it carefully to avoid alerting the watchers he was sure were there.
"Well?"
Talon asked. Talon had been around Sparhawk long enough to know the signs that the big Pandian was using magic.
"They're out there," Sparhawk replied. "Three of them that I can pick up." "Are they concentrating on us?" Stragan asked tensely.
Sparhawk shook his head.
"Their attention's sort of generalized. They aren't Styrix, so they won't know I've gone looking for them. Let's just move along. If they start to follow us, I'll let you know."
The Seaman's Rest was a square, tidy inn, festooned with fishnets and other nautical decorations. It was run by a burly, retired sea captain and his equally burly wife. They brooked no nonsense under their roof, and they recited a long list of house rules to each prospective tenant before they would accept his money. Sparhawk had not even heard of some of the things that were prohibited.
"Where to now?"
Talon asked, after they had stowed their sea bags in their room and come back out into the muddy street.
"Back to the waterfront," Stragan replied. "The chief of the local thieves is a man named Estakin. He deals extensively with smugglers and with sailors who pilfer things from cargo holds. I've got a letter from Kaalador. Ostensibly, we're here to make sure that he got his money's worth during the harvest festival. Our Junis aren't generally trusted, so Estakin won't be too surprised to see us."
Estakin the Arjuni was a man who had clearly been destined for a life of crime from the day he was born. He had what was perhaps the most evil face Sparhawk had ever seen. His left eye peered perpetually in a northeasterly direction, and he had a pronounced squint. His beard was sparse and straggly, and his skin was blotched with a scaly disease. He scratched at his face almost continually, showering white flakes as if from a winter sky. His high-pitched nasal voice was very much like the whine of a hungry mosquito, and he reeked of garlic, cheap wine, and pickled herring.
"Is Kaalador accusing me of cheating him, Vimer?"
he demanded with some show of indignation.
"Of course not."
Stragan leaned back in the rickety chair in the back room of the smelly waterfront dive.
"If he thought that, you'd already be dead. He wants to know if we missed anybody, that's all. Were any local people particularly upset when the bodies started to turn up?"
Estakin squinted at Stragan with his good eye.
"What's it worth to him?"
he haggled.
"We've been instructed to let you live if you cooperate,"
Stragan countered in a cool voice.
"You can't threaten me like that, Vimer,"
Estakin blustered.
"I wasn't threatening you, old boy. I was just letting you know how things stand. Let's get to the point here. Who got excited here in Varessa after the killings?"
"Not very many, really."
Stragan's chilly manner had evidently persuaded Estakin to behave himself.
There was a Styric here who was fairly free with his money before the harvest festival.
What was he buying?
Information, mostly. He was on the list Kalidor gave me, but he managed to get away. Rode off into the jungle. I've got a couple of local cutthroats on his trail.
I'd sort of like to talk with him before they put him to sleep.
Not much chance, Vimer. They're a long way out in the bush by now.
Estakin scratched at his forehead, stirring up another snow flurry.
I'm not sure why Kalidor wanted all those people killed, he said. And I don't really want to know, but I'm getting a whiff or two of politics. And here in Arjuna, that means Scarpa. You might want to warn Kalidor to be very careful. I've talked with a few deserters from that rebel army in the jungle. We've all heard stories about how crazy Scarpa is. But let me tell you, my friend, the stories don't even come close. If only half of what I've heard is true, Scarpa's the craziest man who ever lived.
Sparhawk's stomach gave a lurch, and then it settled into a cold knot.
Father?
Sparhawk sat up in bed quickly.
Are you awake?
The child goddess asked, her voice roaring in his mind.
Of course. Please lower your voice a bit. You're jarring my teeth.
I wanted to be sure I had your attention. Some things have happened. Barrett and Khalad got some new instructions from Krager. They're supposed to go to Sopal now instead of coming here to Baressa.
Sparhawk swore.
Please don't use that kind of language, Father. I am just a little girl, you know.
He ignored that.
Is the trade going to take place in Sopal?
It's hard to say. Bevier's been in touch with me, too. Colton talked with an outlaw who's been selling beer to the soldiers in the Tayos, and he says that Scarpa's gone back there. Then the outlaw told Colton that Scarpa had two Aleen women with him when he returned.
Sparhawk's heart leapt.
Was he sure?
Colton thinks so. The fellow didn't have any reason to lie about it. Of course, Colton's beer merchant didn't actually see them for himself, so don't get your hopes up too much. It could be a very carefully planted story. Zalasta's in the Tayos, and he could be trying to lure you there, or trying to trick you into giving away any secrets you might have tucked up your sleeve. He knows you well enough to know that you'll try to do something he doesn't expect.
Is there any way you could find out for sure if your mother's in the Tayos?
I'm afraid not. I could slip around Scarpa easily enough, but Zalasta would sense me immediately. It's too risky.
What else is going on?
Ulath and Tinian have reached the Troll Gods. Gnome's going to take them to Sopal in that frozen time he's so fond of, and they'll be there when Barrett and Khalad arrive. Gnome knows another way to play around with time, so he's going to skip Ulath and Tinian from moment to moment. It's a little complicated, but they'll be there and watching, and nobody will be able to see them. If Scarpa and Zalasta try to make the trade in Sopal, Tinian and Ulath will be right on top of them to rescue Mother and Aileen.
Zalasta can follow them into that frozen moment, you know.
That wouldn't really pay him, Father. Quaj was outraged when he heard about Mother, so he's going to be lurking in no time. If Zalasta tries to follow Ulath and Tinian, Quaj will set him on fire, and the fire won't ever go out.
I could learn to grow fond of Quaj.
Sifrinia and Zanisha are in Delphaeus, Aphriel continued. Edamus is being tiresome, but the news about Clell shook his tree, so I'll probably be able to coax him down out of the branches. He knows that Mother's captivity puts the arrangement you have with Sedan at risk, so he's agreed to help us rescue her. I'll keep working on him. If I can push him just a little farther, he might agree to let the Delphae come out of their valley. They could be enormously helpful to us.
Why didn't you tell me about all of this earlier?
What would you have done if I had, Sparhawk? Jumped over the side of Sorgai's ship and swum ashore?
I need to know these things when they happen, Aphriel.
Why? Let me take care of the fretting and worrying, Sparhawk. All it does is make you foul-tempered.
He let that pass.
I'll tell this to Belium.
Absolutely not. We don't dare open that box. Sirgon or Clell will feel Belium instantly if we do.
Didn't you know? He asked her mildly. I don't have to open the box to speak with Bellium. We can talk with each other right through the gold.
Why didn't you tell me?
What would you have done if I had? Jumped into the sea and come swimming after Sorgai's ship?
There was a long moment of silence.
You really enjoy turning my own words around and throwing them back in my teeth like that, don't you, Sparhawk?
Naturally. Was there anything else you'd like to share with me, Divine One?
But the sense of her presence was gone, leaving only a slightly huffy silence behind.
Where's, Vimer? Sparhawk asked Talon as the boy entered the room a few minutes later.
He's out attending to something, Talon replied evasively.
Attending to what?
He asked me not to tell you.
All right. I'm asking you to ignore him. And I'm right here where I can get my hands on you.
That's a crude way to put it.
Nobody's perfect. What's he up to?
Talon sighed. One of Estakin's men stopped by, just after you came up to go to bed. He said that there are 3 Alenes in town who are letting it be known they'll pay good money for information about any strangers who seem to be settling in for a long stay. Vimer decided to look them up. Talon glanced meaningfully at the walls of their small room. I guess that he probably wants to find out just exactly what they mean by good money. You know Vimer when there's some profit to be made.
He should have told me, Sparhawk said cautiously. I'm not any more allergic to a quick profit than he is.
Sharing isn't one of Vimer's strong points, Fran. Talon touched his ear and then laid a finger to his lips. Why don't we go out and see if we can find him?
Good idea.
Sparhawk quickly pulled on his clothes, and the two of them clattered down the stairs and out into the street.
I just had a religious experience, Sparhawk murmured as they walked into the noisy area near the docks.
Oh?
One of those divine visitations.
Ah, what did your divine visitor have to say?
A broken-nosed friend of ours got another one of those notes. He's been told to go to Sopal instead of coming here.
Talon muttered a fairly vile oath.
My feelings exactly. Isn't that Vimer coming up the street?
Sparhawk pointed at a blond man in a tar-smeared smock who was lurching unsteadily toward them. Talon peered at the fellow. I think you're right. He made a face. The ladies who changed things around may have gone a little far. He doesn't even walk the same anymore.
What are you two doing out this late? Stragan asked as he joined them. We got lonesome, Sparhawk replied in a flat tone of voice. For me? I'm touched. Let's go for a walk on the beach, my friends. I find myself yearning for the smell of salt water and the nice loud sound of waves crashing on the sand.
They walked on past the last of the wharves and then out onto the sand. The clouds had blown off, and there was a bright moon. They reached the water's edge and stood looking out at the long combers rolling in off the South Tamil Sea to hammer noisily on the wet sand.
What have you been up to, Stragan? Sparhawk demanded bluntly. Business, old boy. I just enlisted us in the intelligence service of the other side. You did what? The 3 you sensed when we first got here needed a few good men. I volunteered our services. Are you out of your mind? Of course not. Think about it, Sparhawk. What better way is there to gather information? Our celebration of the Harvest Festival thinned their ranks drastically, so they can't afford to be choosy. I paid Estakin to vouch for us, and then I told them a few lies. They're expecting a certain Sir Sparhawk to flood the town with sharp-eyed people. We're supposed to report anybody we see who's acting a little suspicious. I provided them with a prime suspect. Oh? Who was that? Captain Sorgai's bosun. You know, the fellow with the whip.
Sparhawk suddenly laughed.
That was a truly vicious thing to do, Stragan. I rather liked it myself.
Athriel came by to call, Talon said. She told Sparhawk that Barrett and my brother have been ordered to change direction. Now they're supposed to go to Sopal on the coast of the Sea of Arjun.
Stragan swore.
I already said that, Talon told him.
We probably should have expected it, Sparhawk said. Krager's working for the other side, and he knows us well enough to anticipate some of the things we might try to do.
He suddenly banged his fist into the palm of his hand.
I wish I could talk with Sophronia, he burst out. You can, as I recall, Stragan said. Didn't Afriel fix it once so that you and Sophronia talked when she was in Sarsos and you were in Samora?
Sparhawk suddenly felt more than a little foolish.
I'd forgotten about that, he admitted. That's all right, old boy, Stragan excused him. You've got a lot on your mind. Why don't you have a word with her divine little whimsicality and see if she can arrange a council of war someplace? I think it might be time for a good old-fashioned get-together.
Sparhawk knew where he was before he even opened his eyes. The fragrance of wildflowers and tree blossoms immediately identified the eternal spring of Afriel's own private reality.
Art thou now awake, Annika?
The white deer asked him, touching his hand with her nose.
Yea, gentle creature, he replied,
opening his eyes and touching the side of her face. He was in the pavilion again, and he looked out through the open flap at the flower-studded meadow, the sparkling azure sea, and the rainbow-colored sky above.
The others do await thy coming on the Ayat,
the hind advised him.
We must hasten then, he said, rising from his bed.
He followed her from the pavilion out into the meadow, where the white tigress indulgently watched the awkward play of her large-footed cubs. He rather idly wondered if these were the same cubs she had been tending when he had first visited this enchanted realm a half-dozen years ago.
Well, of course they are, Sparhawk,
Afriel's voice murmured in his ear.
Nothing ever changes here.
He smiled. The white deer led him to that beautiful, impractical boat, a swan-necked craft with sails like wings, elaborate embellishment, and so much of its main structure above the waterline that a sneeze would have capsized it, had it existed in the real world.
Critic,
Afriel's voice accused him.
It's your dream, Divine One. You can put any impossibility in it that you want.
Oh, thank you, Sparhawk,
she said with effusive irony. The emerald green ayat, crowned with ancient oaks and Afriel's alabaster temple, nestled in the sapphire sea, and the swan-necked boat touched the golden beach in only minutes. Sparhawk looked around as he stepped out onto the sand. The disguises most of them wore in the real world had been discarded, and they all had their own features here in this eternal dream. Some of them had been here before. Those who had not had expressions of bemused wonderment as they all lounged in the lush grass that blanketed the slopes of the Enchanted Isle. The child goddess and Sophronia sat side by side on an alabaster bench in the temple. Afriel's expression was pensive, and she was playing a complex styric melody in a minor key on her many-chambered pipes.
"What kept you, Sparhawk?"
she asked, lowering the rude instrument.
"The person in charge of my travel arrangements took me on a little side trip," he replied. "Are we all here?"
"Everybody who's supposed to be. Come up here, all of you, and let's get started."
They climbed up the slope to the temple.
"Where is this place?"
Sarabian asked in an awed voice.
"Afriel carries it in her mind, Your Majesty," Vanyan replied. "She invites us here from time to time. She likes to show it off."
"Don't be insulting, Vanyan," the child goddess told him.
"Well, don't you?"
"Of course, but it's not nice to come right out and say it like that."
"I feel different here for some reason," Kalidor noted. "Better somehow." Vanyan smiled.
"It's a very healthy place, my friend," he said. "I was seriously ill at the end of the Zemok War, dying, actually. Afriel brought me here for a month or so, and I was disgustingly healthy by the time I left."
They all reached the little temple and took seats on the marble benches lining the columned perimeter. Sparhawk looked around, frowning.
"Where's Emban?" he asked their hostess.
"It wouldn't have been appropriate for him to be here, Sparhawk. Your Aline god makes exceptions in the case of the Church Knights, but he'd probably throw a fit if I brought one of the patriarchs of his church here. I didn't invite the Aetons either, or the Paloi. She smiled. Neither group is comfortable with the idea of religious diversity, and this place would probably confuse them. She rolled her eyes upward. You wouldn't believe how long it took me to persuade Eudamus to permit Zanisha to come. He doesn't approve of me. He thinks I'm frivolous.
You? Sparhawk feigned some surprise. How could he possibly believe something like that?
Let's get at this, Sophronia said. Why don't you start, Barrett? We know generally what happened, but we don't have any details.
Yes, Lady Sophronia, the young knight replied. Halad and I were coming down the coast, and we'd been watched from almost the moment we came ashore. I used the spell and identified the watcher as a Styrek. He came to us after several days and gave us another one of those notes from Krager. This one told us to continue down the coast, but once we get past the Tamil Mountains, we're supposed to cut across country to Sopal instead of continuing south. We're to get further instructions there. It was definitely from Krager. It had another lock of Queen Elana's hair in it.
I'm going to talk with Krager about that when I catch up with him, Halad said in a bleak tone of voice. I want to be sure he understands just how much we resent his touching the Queen's hair. Trust me, Sparhawk. Before I'm done with him, he's going to regret it. Profoundly.
I've got enormous confidence in you, Halad, Sparhawk replied.
Oh,
Halad said then.
There's something I almost forgot. Does anybody know of a way to make one of our horses limp without actually hurting him? I think Barrett and I might want to be able to slow down from time to time without causing suspicion. An intermittently lame horse should explain it to the people who are watching us.
I'll talk with Farron, Afriel promised.
You won't need to limp on your way to Sopal, Ulaf told Khalad. Gnome's going to see to it that Tinian and I are there long before you arrive. You might be able to see us when you get there, but you might not. I'm having a little trouble explaining some things to the troll god. We'll be able to see you, though. If I can't make Gnome understand, I'll slip a note in your pocket.
If we do come out in the open, you'll just love our traveling companion.
Tinian laughed. Barrett gave him a puzzled look. Who's that, Sir Tinian?
Blockus. He's a troll.
It's Gnome's idea, Ulaf explained. I have to go through a little ceremony before I can talk with the troll gods. Blockus doesn't, so having him along speeds up communication. Anyway, we'll be there and out of sight. If Scarpa and Zalasta try to make the trade in Sopal, we'll step out of no time, grab the lot of you, and disappear again.
That's assuming that they're taking Queen Elana to Sopal to make the exchange, Itania said. We've got some things that don't match up, though. Sir Colton picked up a rumor that Scarpa's holding the Queen and her maid in the tiles.
I wouldn't want to wager the farm on it, Your Excellency, Colton said. It's second-hand information at best. The fellow I talked with probably isn't bright enough to make up stories, and he didn't have any reason to lie to me. But he got his information from somebody else. So that makes the whole thing a little wormy.
You've put your finger on the problem, Sir Colton, Sarabian said. Soldiers gossip worse than old women. He tugged at one earlobe and looked up at the rainbow-colored sky. The other side knows that I wasn't entirely dependent on the Ministry of the Interior for information, so they'll expect me to have ears in the tiles. This story Sir Colton heard could have been planted for our benefit. Prince Sparhawk, is there any way at all you could use Bellium to confirm the rumor? It's too dangerous, Sophronia said flatly. Zalasta would know immediately if Sparhawk did that.
I'm not so sure, little mother, Sparhawk disagreed. It was just recently that we found out that the gold box doesn't totally isolate Bellium. I'm getting a strong feeling that a great deal of what we think we know about Bellium is pure misdirection. The rings evidently don't really mean anything at all, except possibly as a means of communication. And the gold box doesn't appear to be relevant either. It could be an idea Bellium planted
to keep us from enclosing it in iron. I'm guessing, but I'd say that the touch of iron is still painful to it. But whether it's painful enough to actually confine it isn't all that certain.
He's right, you know, Aphriel told her sister. A great deal of what we think we know about Belium came from Gwerig, and Belium had absolute control of Gwerig. Our mistake was believing that Gwerig knew what he was talking about.
That still doesn't answer the question about using Belium to investigate things in the tiles, Sparhawk said, and it's not the sort of thing I'd want to experiment with.
I will go to Natios, Zenisha said quietly. It had been mine intent to go unseen to Sopal, but Sir Tinian and Sir Ulof will be there already, and well able to determine if the Queen be truly there. I will go to Natios and seek her there instead.
Absolutely not, Sarabian said. I forbid it.
I am not subject to the Sarabian of Tamali, she reminded him. But fear not. There is no peril involved for me. None will know that I am there, and I can reach out to those who are about me and share their thoughts. I will soon be able to determine whether or no the Queen and her maidservant are in Natios. This is precisely the kind of service we offered when we concluded our pact with Annika.
It's too dangerous, he said stubbornly.
It seemeth me that thou hast forgot mine other gift, Sarabian of Tamali, she told him quite firmly. The curse of Edamus is still upon me, and my touch is still death, and I choose it so. Fear not for me, Sarabian, for should necessity compel me to it, I can spread death and terror through Natios. Though it doth cause me pain to confess it, I can make Natios once more a waste, a weed-choked ruin populated only by the dead.
Chapter 10 The city of Sarna in western Tamil proper lay just to the south of the Aton border in the deep gorge of the river from which it took its name. The surrounding mountains were steep and rugged, and were covered with dark evergreens which sighed endlessly in the prevailing wind sweeping down out of the wilderness to the north. The weather was cold, and the leaden sky spat stinging pellets of snow as Vanyan's army of church knights slowly descended the long, steep road leading down into the gorge. Vanyan and Itania, muffled in their heavy cloaks, rode at the head of the column.
"I'd have much preferred to stay on Aphriel's island," Itania said, shivering and pulling his cloak tighter. "I've never been particularly fond of this time of year."
"We're almost there, Your Excellency," Vanyan replied.
"Is it customary to campaign in the winter time, Lord Vanyan?" Itania asked. "In Eosia, I mean."
"We try to avoid it, Your Excellency," Vanyan replied. "The Lamorks attack each other in the winter, but the rest of us usually have better sense."
"It's a miserable time to go to war."
Vanyan smiled faintly.
"That it is, my friend. But that's not why we avoid it. It's a question of economics, really. It's more expensive to campaign in winter, because you have to buy hay for the horses. It's the expense that keeps a lean king's peaceful when there's snow on the ground."
Vanyan stood up in his stirrups to peer ahead.
"Petwana's waiting," he said. "We'd better ride down to meet her."
Itania nodded, and they pushed their horses into a jolting trot. The Queen of Aton had left them behind at Dasan on the eastern edge of the mountains, determined to come on ahead. She had several very good reasons, of course, but Vanyan privately suspected that her decision had been influenced more by impatience than necessity. Petwana was too polite to speak of it, but she clearly had little use for horses, and she seldom missed an opportunity to outrun them. She and Engessa, both garbed in otter skins, waited at the roadside about a mile outside the city.
"Was there any trouble?" the Aton Queen asked.
"No, Your Majesty," Vanyan replied, his black armor clinking as he swung down out of his saddle. "We were watched, but there's nothing unusual about that. Has anything been happening in Seneska?"
"They're moving up to the border, Vanyan Preceptor," Engessa replied quietly. "They aren't being very subtle about it. We've been disrupting their supply lines and ambushing their scouting parties just to keep them off balance, but it's fairly obvious that they plan to come across the line in force."
Vanyan nodded. It's more or less what we expected then. If it's all right with you, Your Majesty, I'd like to get my men settled in before we get too involved in discussions. I can always think better after I've seen to all the details.
Of course, Batuana agreed. And Gesa Eitan and I have arranged quarters for them. When will you be leaving for Samar?
Tomorrow or the next day, Batuana Queen. Takumi's Paloi are probably spread a little thin down there. He has a lot of ground to cover.
He sent back to Pella for more men, Vanyan Lord, and Gesa advised. You'll have a sizable force in Samar in a week or so.
Good. Let me go back and hurry the knights along. We have much to discuss.
Night settled early at the bottom of the gorge of the River Sarna, and it was fully dark by the time Vanyan joined the others in the headquarters of the city's Eitan garrison. Like all Eitan structures, the building was severely utilitarian and devoid of any embellishment. The lone exception in the conference room in which they gathered was a very large map covering one entire wall. The map was brightly colored and dotted here and there with fanciful illustrations. Vanyan had bathed hurriedly and now wore plain clothing. The years had taught him that armor was impressive and even useful at times, but that no one had yet devised a way to make it comfortable or to eliminate its characteristic smell.
Are the quarters satisfactory?
Batuana inquired politely.
Most satisfactory, Your Majesty, he replied, settling into a chair. Have you been advised of the details of our meeting with the child goddess?
She nodded.
Itania Ambassador gave me a report, she replied.
She paused.
One is curious to know why one was excluded, she added.
Theological considerations, Your Majesty, Vanyan explained. As I understand it, the gods have an exquisitely complex etiquette in these situations. Afriel didn't want to offend your god by inviting his children to her island. There were some other rather conspicuous absences as well. Emperor Sarabian was there, and Ambassador Itania, but Foreign Minister Oscania wasn't.
Itania frowned slightly.
The Emperor and I are skeptics, agnostics, I suppose you could call us, but Oscania's an out-and-out atheist. Would that account for it? It might. I'll ask Afriel the next time I talk with her.
And Gesa looked around.
I didn't see Kring Domi when we met you, Vanyan Preceptor, he noted.
Kring took his men and veered off toward Samar not long after you and Her Majesty left. He thought he'd be more useful there than he would here in Sarna. And you know how the Western Paloi feel about mountains and forests. Have the Seneskans made any forays across the border as yet?
No, Vanyan Preceptor, Angessa replied. They're massing in staging areas and bringing up supplies.
He rose and went to the map.
A large force moved out of Sinestra a while back, he said, pointing at the Senescan capital. They're positioned near the border, more or less opposite us here. Another force has taken up a similar position just across the line from Samar.
Vanyan nodded.
Sirgon's more like a general than a god in most ways. He's not going to leave fortified positions to his rear. He'll have to neutralize Samar and Sarna before he can strike any deeper into Tamil proper. I'd say that the force you're facing here has been ordered to take Sarna, seal the southern border of Eitan, and then swing northeast toward Tualas. I'm sure they'd rather not have the entire Eitan nation come swarming down out of these mountains.
There aren't enough Seneskans living to keep my people hemmed in, Batuana told him.
I'm sure of it, Your Majesty, but there probably are enough to slow you down, and Sirgon can recruit armies from the past to hinder you all the more.
He studied the map, his lips pursed.
I think I see where he's going, he said. Mathurians on a peninsula, and that narrow neck of land at Tosa is the key to that. If I had to wager anything on it, I'd say that the main battle's going to take place there. Scarpa will move north out of Natayos. Probably the southern Seneskans are planning to capture Samar, and then swing around the north shore of the Sea of Arjun to join him somewhere in the vicinity of the Tamil Mountains. From there, the combined army can march up the west shore of the Gulf of Mysi to Tosa.
He smiled faintly.
Of course, there's a very nasty surprise waiting for them in the Tamil Mountains. I'd imagine that before this is over, Sirgon will wish that he'd never heard of the trolls.
I will send an army out of northern Aton to Tosa, Vanyan Preceptor, Betwana said, but I'll leave enough of my people along the southern and eastern borders to tie up half of the Seneskins. In the meantime, I think we can disrupt their preparations, Angessa added. Raids in forces across that border will delay their main attack.
And that's all we really need, Vanyan chuckled. If we can delay them long enough, Sirgon's going to have 100,000 church knights swarming across his western frontier. I think he'll forget about Tosa at that point.
Don't worry about him, Fran, Stregan told Sparhawk. He can take care of himself. I think we sometimes forget that he's only a boy, Vimer. He doesn't even shave regularly yet. Reldan stopped being a boy before his voice started to change.
Stregan leaned back on his bed reflectively.
Those of us in our particular line of work tend to lose our childhoods, he said. It might have been nice to roll hoops and catch polywogs, but...
He shrugged.
What are you going to do when this is all over? Sparhawk asked him. Assuming that we survive. There's a certain lady of our acquaintance who proposed marriage to me a while back. It's part of a business arrangement that's very attractive. The notion of marriage never really appealed to me, but the business proposition's just too good to pass up.
There's more, too, isn't there?
Yes, Stregan admitted. After what she did back in the Therian that night, I'm not about to let her get away from me. She's one of the coolest and most courageous people I've ever met. Pretty, too. You noticed.
Stregan sighed.
I'm afraid I'm going to end up being at least semi-respectable, my friend. Shocking, isn't it? First, though, there's this other little matter I want to deal with. I think I'll present my beloved with the head of a certain Astellian poet of our acquaintance. If I can find a good taxidermist, I may even have it stuffed and mounted for her. It's the kind of wedding present every girl dreams of. Maybe not every girl, Stregan grinned. But I'm in love with a very special lady.
But there are so many of them, Ulat, Blockhoff said plaintively. They would not miss just one, would they?
I am certain they would, Blockhoff,
Ulaf told the huge brown-furred troll.
The man-things are not like the deer. They pay very close attention to the other members of the herd. If you eat one of them, they will know that we are here. Catch and eat one of their dogs instead.
Is dog good to eat?
I am not sure. Eat one and tell me if it is good.
Blockhoff grumbled and squatted down on his haunches. The process Gnome had called breaking the moments in two pieces produced some rather strange effects. The brightness of noon was dimmed to twilight, for one thing, and the citizens of Sopal seemed to walk about their town with a fast, jerky kind of movement, for another. The god of Eat had assured them that because they were present in only a small part of each instant, they had been rendered effectively invisible. Ulaf could see a rather large logical flaw in the explanation, but the spell did work. Tinian came back up the street shaking his head.
It's impossible to understand them, he reported. I can pick up a word or two now and then, but the rest is pure gibberish.
It is talking in bird noises again,
Blockhoff complained.
You'd better speak in trollish, Tinian, Ulaf said. You're making Blockhoff nervous.
I forgot.
Tinian admitted, reverting to the hideous language of the trolls.
I am, he groped. What is the word that means that you want it that you had not done something?
He asked their shaggy companion.
There is no such word, Tinian,
Blockhoff replied.
Can you ask Gnome to make it so that we can understand what the man-things are saying?
Ulaf asked.
Why? What does it matter?
Blockhoff's face was puzzled.
If we can know what they are saying, we will know which ones of the herd we should follow,
Tinian explained.
They will be the ones who will know about the wicked ones.
They do not all know?
Blockoff asked with some amazement.
No, only some know.
The man-things are very strange. I will talk with Gnome. He may understand this.
He rose to his feet, towering over them.
I will do it as soon as I come back.
Where are you going?
Tinian asked politely.
I am hungry. I will go eat a dog. Then I will come back and talk with Gnome.
He paused.
I can bring a dog back for you as well, if you are also hungry.
No, Blockoff, Tinian replied. I do not think I am hungry right now. It was good of you to ask, though.
We are packmates now,
Blockoff shrugged.
It is right to do this.
And he shambled off down the street.
It's not really all that far,
Afriel told her sister, as they rode with Vanisha out of the Valley of Delphaeus toward the town of Dirges in southern Aton.
But Edamus is still reluctant to help us, so I think I'd better mind my manners. He might be offended if I start tampering in the home of his children.
You've never used that word to describe it before, Sophronia noted.
Sparhawk's influence, I guess, the child goddess replied. It's a useful sort of term. It glosses over things that we don't want to discuss in front of strangers. After we get to Dirges, we'll be well clear of the home of the Delphae. Then I'll be able to tamper to my heart's content.
How long dost thou think it will take us to reach Natayos, goddess?
Zanisha asked. She had once again altered her coloration and suppressed her inner radiance to conceal her racial characteristics.
No more than a few hours, in real time.
Afriel shrugged.
I can't quite jump us around the way Belium does, but I can cover a lot of ground in a hurry when there's an emergency. If things were really desperate, I could fly us there.
Sophronia shuddered.
It's not that desperate, Afriel.
Zanisha gave her Styric sister a puzzled look.
It makes her queasy, Afriel explained.
No, Afriel, Sophronia corrected. Not queasy. Terrified. It's a horrible experience, Zanisha. She's done it to me about 5 times in the past 300 years. I'm an absolute wreck for weeks afterward.
I keep telling you not to look down, Sophronia, Afriel told her. If you just look at the clouds instead of down at the ground, it wouldn't bother you so much.
I can't help myself, Afriel, Sophronia told her.
Is it truly so disturbing, sister mine? Zanisha asked.
You couldn't even begin to imagine it, Zanisha. You skim along with nothing but about 5,000 feet of empty air between you and the ground. It's awful.
We'll do it the other way, Afriel assured her.
I'll start composing a prayer of thanksgiving immediately.
We'll stay the night in Dirges, Afriel told them. And then tomorrow morning we'll run down to Natayos. Sophronia and I'll stay out in the woods, Zanisha, and you can go into town and have a look around. If Mother's really being held there, we should be able to bring this little crisis to an end in short order. Once Sparhawk knows exactly where she is, he'll fall on Scarpa and his father like a vengeful mountain. Natayos won't even be a ruin anymore when he's done. It'll just be a big hole in the ground.
He actually saw them, Talon reported. He described them too well to have just been making it up. The young thief had just returned from his foray into the seamier parts of Baressa.
What sort of fellow was he? Sparhawk asked. This is too important for us to be taken in by random gossip.
He's a Dacite, Talon replied. A gutter snipe from Jura. His politics go about as far as his purse.
His main reason for joining Scarpa's army in the first place was his enthusiasm for the idea of taking part in the looting of Mytherium. We are not talking about a man with high ideals here. When he got to Natayos and found out that there might be actual fighting involved, he started to lose interest. Anyway, I found him in one of the shabbiest taverns I've ever seen, and he was roaring drunk. Believe me, Fran, he was in no condition to lie to me. I told him that I was thinking of joining Scarpa's army, and he turned all fatherly on me.
Don't even shink about it, boy. It's terrible there.
That sort of thing. He said that Scarpa's a raving lunatic with delusions of invincibility who thinks he can just blow on the Aetons and make them go away.
He said he'd just about decided to desert anyway, and then Scarpa came back to Natayos, along with Craeger, Elrond, and Baron Perak. They had the Queen and Aileen with them, and Zalasta met them at the gate.
The Dacite happened to be nearby, so he could hear what they were saying. Evidently, Zelasta still got a few good manners, so he wasn't very happy about the way Scarpa had been treating his prisoners. The two of them had an argument about it, and Zelasta tied his son into a very complicated knot with magic. I guess Scarpa was squirming around like a worm on a hot rock for a while. Then Zelasta took the ladies to a large house that had been fixed up for them. From what my deserter said, the house comes fairly close to being luxurious, if you discount the bars on the windows.
He could have been coached, Sparhawk fretted. Maybe he wasn't as drunk as he appeared to be.
Believe me, Fran, he was drunk, Talon assured him. I cut a purse on my way to that tavern, just to keep in practice, so I had plenty of money. I poured enough strong drink into him to stun a regiment.
I think he's right, Fran, Spiggins said. There are just too many details for this to be a contrived story.
And if this deserter had been sent to spin cobwebs for our benefit, why would he waste time and effort entertaining a young pickpocket? Talon added. None of us looked the way we did last time Zelasta saw us, and I doubt that even he could have guessed how Sophronia and Zanisha put their heads together to modify us.
I still think we should hold off, Sparhawk said. Afriel's going to put Zanisha into Natayos in a day or so, and Zanisha can find out for sure if it's really Aelana who's locked up in that house. We could at least get closer, Stragan said. Why? Distance doesn't mean anything to my blue friend here.
Sparhawk touched the bulge under the front of his tunic.
Just as soon as I know for certain that Aelana's there, we'll go pay Zelasta and his bastard a call. I might even invite Quads to come along. He has some plans for them that sort of interest me.
The light was suddenly very bright, and the citizens of Sopal suddenly stopped jerking around like marionettes on strings and started to walk like normal humans. It had taken a half a day to explain to Gnome why it was necessary for them to return to real time, and the god of Eat still had some serious reservations about the whole idea.
I'll wait in that tavern just up the street, Tinian said to Ulaf, as the two of them stepped out of the narrow alley. Do you remember the password? Ulaf grunted.
I shouldn't be long, he said.
He walked across the street toward the pair of travelers who had just come into town.
That's an interesting-looking saddle bow you've got there, neighbor, he said to one of them,
a broken-nosed man on a roan horse.
What's it made of? Ram's horn?
Barrett gave him a startled look, then glanced quickly around the narrow street near the east gate of Sopal. I didn't think to ask the saddlemaker, Sergeant, he replied, noticing the blonde Aline's tattered-looking uniform jacket. Maybe you could give my young friend and me some advice.
Advice is free. Go ahead and ask.
Do you happen to know of a good inn here in Sopal?
The one my friend and I are staying at isn't too bad. It's about 3 streets over,
Ulaf pointed.
It's got the sign of a boar hanging out front, although the picture doesn't look very much like any boar I've ever seen.
We'll look into it.
Maybe my friend and I'll see you there. We're usually in the tap room after supper.
We'll stop by, if we decide to stay there. End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.